The Calculations of the Court, written by Alf Kifu, narrated by Rhea 314. Fandom, the Nine Worlds series by Victoria Goddard. The Lays of the Hearthfire series by Victoria Goddard. Rating teen and up audiences, no archive warnings apply. Chapter 1. A Call to Audit. It had been many years since Rial Lord Iridis was last interviewed for any job. He had not really expected this to ever happen again. Could not, in truth, quite believe it was happening now. Vobu, his chief attendant, seemed equally bemused. He fussed over the choice of robes, something appropriate to the upper secretariat, obviously, with the Iridis house colors, and not overdressed. No half-court costume here. Sir was a subtle man and deserved subtlety. Rial, who knew he relied on Vobu for all matters of taste, was certainly not going to argue with him. It was not as if either of them had anyone else left in the palace who would care. It was not as if he would ever say that out loud, when his attendant put so much time and effort into perfecting his ensembles. He wished, with weary familiarity, that he was more the kind of person who enjoyed clothes. Vobu deserved more than this placid acceptance. The usual mental corollary, that Vobu deserved better in general, also, as usual, went unsaid. The pair of them had been the only members of House Iridis to survive the fall of Astandalas. Rial, as the disfavored second son, for all his family's greatness, it had been abundantly clear to Astandalas that they would gain no advantage from inviting him to any of their parties, and Vobu, as the lowest footman in the pecking order, the one who had to miss the Silverheart festivities on his account. "Go then, leave me to it," young Rial had snapped that evening, cold with anger. "I won't tell them." And young Vobu had refused, with sullen resentment that he could see now was justified. What right had he to tell anyone of the household to neglect their assigned duties? His parents would have been furious if they found out, and whatever the consequences of 19-year-old Rial, the outcome for Vobu, 5 years younger, a nobody entirely reliant on House Iridis for food, clothing, prospects, and protection, would have been far worse. It had been bitter, in the years that followed, knowing that Vobu blamed Rial for their survival, and hated him, and hated himself, and yet would not leave him. Rial had offered, more than once, any form of support or sponsorship he needed, and yet Vobu refused to go. He would not leave Rial in the chaotic aftermath of the fall, nor when it became clear that the majority of the Iridis lands and fortune were lost forever on Isthar. Nor when Rial called an end to the search for his family and considered just giving up, returning his empty title to the sleeping emperor and going. Well, the lack of destinations was the problem, wasn't it? Rial Iridis had his skills, but they were the skills of a steward, a trusted manager. A conniving tradesman, a stinking merchant, a measly paper pusher, my son? His father's voice still hissed in his ear even now. They were not skills well suited to survival as a traveling stranger in the magic-rent world of Zunith, a place he had never imagined visiting before the cataclysm landed the palace here. And so he had stayed, and Vobu had stayed with him, making the best of the life they had found in Solara. It should not have been a relief to be shorn away from his wealth and his noble family, but it was. Princess Indrigan and Lady Givane did not care for the glory, or otherwise, of House Iridis. They were happy to keep a competent senior manager in the upper secretariat, and there was nobody left to needle him now for his fussy ways, or his inability to hold a sword, or his delight in numbers and commerce. Only Vobu remained to disappoint, and he offered no spoken commentary, merely insisted that as long as Rial needed an attendant, he could not leave. Vobu, with great ceremony, placed his square and saggy formal hat of rank neatly on top of his close-cropped bureaucrat's hair. Rial Iridis regarded his reflection and found it adequate to the occasion. "Thank you," he said. "I look magnificent." He caught the pleased quirk of Obu's lips in the mirror. "Always, my lord," his attendant said, then hesitantly. "This new position, it is at the treasury." "Lord Lovelace is treasurer now," said Rial. "And they've asked me to speak about a role. I believe it would be with them." "And why they do not make you treasurer, I do not understand," said Vobu, with a sharper-than-necessary tug to settle the neckline of Rial's robes. "You are Lord Eridus." "Thank you, but I think Lord Lovelace is an excellent choice," said Rial mildly, which was true, and not entirely honest. He did think that Lovelace would be an excellent treasurer. He did also think that he himself could do as well, if not better. But if Lord Eridus was made treasurer, he would know in his bones that it was because he was Lord Eridus, the last scion of a noble house. It would not be because Rial knew his way around government finances. He stood up, turned, and leaned on the back of his chair, watching as Vobu tidied away all the accoutrements of his trade. "Do you think I should take a job with them?" Vobu was folding a swath of silk with a series of small flourishes. "You are surely on track to be made senior minister at trade now. Why take a junior post?"
"Junior ministers at the treasury are as powerful, more powerful than the head of a small department,"
Rial pointed out. "Yes, but you are used to charting your own course, my lord," said Vobu.
"I suppose I am at that," he replied. "Thank you."
"Thank you, my lord," said Vobu, firmly putting him in his place. Rial kept his sigh to himself. Vobu had unbent enough to talk freely with him and share his thoughts, and he was thankful. It was more than he had had for many decades. The treasurer's apartments were familiar, and so was the new treasurer, although they had been a junior minister most of the time Rial had known them. Lord Lovelace was new to their title, which went with the job, and rumor had it that they were wading through an astonishing mess that the recently departed Lady Berevin had left in her wake. They were also, despite the upheaval, as friendly and welcoming as ever, asking after his department and his household, and whether he had found much time to go fishing lately. Rial found himself tensing up with a totally unexpected anxiety, sitting up straighter than was necessary on the low, comfy chair, hardly touching the fine jasmine tea that the treasurer's assistant had set out for them both. He was conscious that Lovelace's appearance was slightly disheveled, and their face strained, though their manner was easy.
"You look like you've found less time to go fishing than I have," he blurted out, which was totally incorrect for a lord of Ostendilus, but apparently the right thing to say here, because Lovelace stopped the inconsequential chatter and looked directly at him for the first time, with a more genuine, much wearier smile.
"It's been panning through the muck for gold, I'm afraid," they said.
"It's that bad," said Rial.
Lovelace sighed and wilted slightly with it, releasing that correct pose for a more natural slump in their shoulders.
"I knew it was going to be bad," they said. "Siouten Dang started his audit program here for an excellent reason. Berevin told him that she had never once taken an inventory of the contents of the treasury, if you'll believe it, and didn't even have the wit to know she was admitting to dereliction of duty."
At Riel's involuntary noise of disgust, Lovelace grinned weakly.
"She also made the mistake of trying to butter up Mdang somehow. I don't know the details."
"Ah, well, I can see why she had to go then," said Rial.
He remembered Siouten Mdang's deep suspicion of flattery from the sadly too brief months when Mdang was working in his office, and again from that unfortunate incident with the oily rich woman, Lady What's-Her-Face, who had made the mistake of attempting to persuade him to mis-sell financial products with her.
"And that brings me to why I asked to speak with you," said Lovelace.
Siouten Mdang felt it would be best. He was concerned that it might be difficult for you to discuss this with him directly, but he is looking for somebody willing to join his private office and help coordinate the audit program. Rial froze,
The tea slopped out of the cup he had just lifted from its saucer, no doubt doing terrible things to the sleeve of his silk robe.
Xiao Mdang wants what?
He wants you, said Lovelace.
But why?
Was all Riel could manage. He put the mug back down on the saucer with both hands and clasped them together, an unmanly habit his mother had spent years trying to whip out of him, and found that he was nearly glaring at Lovelace, whose eyebrows had shot up at this reaction.
Why me?
He had tried. He had tried so hard not to lean on the Iridis name. He had volunteered for the emergency posting to trade after the fall, when Princess Indrigan was desperate. With the gates between worlds closed and much of Zunith unreachable, his remit was unrecognizable from Astandalin days. His sharper-edged colleagues left him to the Ministry of Trade with disdain. It was a backwater for a career, he understood that. But the palace needed trade, not for prestige, but for survival, and Riel understood his own value. The Salaran horizon might be low and close, and the safe zone ringed with famine and war, but within this constrained field he could support enterprise and exchange, identify the needs and surpluses, and do his part to keep the palace alive. It was not that different from the first challenge he had embraced as a young man, stewarding the backcountry estates where his parents had sent him to harden up. Riel was terrified of horses and resolutely skived off the training grounds, and he was perilously clumsy with any kind of physical labor, but he had learned, up in the mountains, that he had other skills. He could see patterns in the records and anticipate demand and organize people to make the most out of each season. Within a year, he had doubled the profit margins of the estates, and the bite went out of his people's mockery, and he was touched and a little awed to find that they were covering for him with his family. There were fewer living souls in the whole of Solara after the fall than there had been spread across the three mountain valleys controlled by House Iridis in the Vale of Astandalus, and Riel had played a small but essential role in keeping them all alive. He was proud of that, and sometimes it gave him a savage little glow of satisfaction to think that he had been more used to the Lord Emperor with his scorned love of ledgers than any of his brothers could have been with all their swords and swagger. The tides had shifted, and Lord Iridis, junior minister for trade, had been shifted with them. He had taken up the baton of financial reporting with equal fervor, recognizing that the records at the time of disaster were, if anything, even more important than those kept in peacetime. He had not been reconciled to House Iridis sinking into ignominious irrelevance, whatever he said to Vobu. He had delighted in it. And now, his wits were catching up with him, and he remembered that Xiao Mdang was an outsider to the court, and largely oblivious to the games of favor and status. He would not be asking for Riel because he wanted Lord Iridis, which meant... He told me that you were the only person he ever met in the Upper Secretariat who understood the true importance of accountability, said Lovelace. Their gentleness told Riel just how much of his discomposure was plain on his face. He forced himself to fold his astonishment back under that mild mask that ensured his survival at court.
That seems remarkable, he said.
He told me that you were remarkable, too. Lovelace quirked a smile. For cooking up that scheme to get your books audited at trade. And he didn't say this, but we all know it's true. For giving him enough quiet backing to go after the Master of Offices that first time. You could have shut that down with a word, you know, and you didn't. All of these things were true, and Lovelace was not someone given to cruel practical jokes. And they were regarding him, Riel, not Lord Iridis, but Riel, with steady, slightly amused respect. The shock of the offer was wearing off now, and he was thinking about it, would have to think further, and yet he had cast a line often enough to know that twist and tug when the hook was set. He needed time to think. Cleofer Xiao Mdang joined my office because I won his services from Lady Kuyulush in a game of cards, he said to cover his confusion, and was glad to startle a disbelieving chortle out of Lovelace. I appreciate his courtesy in asking you to approach me in a more traditional manner. I am interested, but I will need some time to consider and to speak with him directly, of course. Lovelace nodded. Of course. He is looking for an answer this week, if possible, and wanted to speak with you directly, too. I could lend you a deck of cards if that would help, they added, eyes glinting with wicked humor. Not necessary, said Rial. Besides, you've got a lot of recruiting to do here, haven't you? So no doubt you're going to need them yourself. He smiled. Tell Lady Kay that I sent you. She'll be delighted. Lovelace was almost as deeply dark-skinned as the high aristocracy. For all that time, their background was obscure. But Rial was almost sure that they were blushing at the very idea. Not for the first time, he blessed Lura and her gift for rattling people. I'll bear that in mind, Eridus, said Lovelace, and switched back into the register of high court formality to show him out of the treasurer's apartments. Rial was hardly aware of the walk back to his office, chewing over the implications and ramifications of this extraordinary offer. It made sense, of course it made sense, to run audits of the government from a perch tucked right under the shelter of the Lord Emperor's golden aura. The Treasury had certainly lost the skills and the practice, or rather, Lovelace needed them urgently to attend to other problems. Things were changing, even in trade. The stack of updates and reports waiting on his desk was full of it. The Emperor was spending a great deal of time out on the terraces that overlooked the Solomon Fens, was reportedly doing some mysterious thing that would make them safe for travelers. If the animals pulling the great barges along the River Dwahai were able to use the paths on both sides of the river, the traffic into Solara from the coast could double, which would mean... And that was only one paper, one initiative. The Orda Natha had released their store of sanctified salt to preserve fish caught along the coast, and Rial Eridus had tracked the price of fish in the palace budget as it fell, and thought of all the people in the market, finding the food they needed at a price they could suddenly afford. And the administrative office was no more, and he was in the middle of a round of recruitment where he could offer the salaries he needed of his own budget to attract trained accountants. Xiao Ndang, Imperial Secretary, was changing the world. It was, in all honesty, a little daunting. He felt his heart beat a little faster as he set the reports aside. He wanted to be part of this. He did. But he needed to test it first. He had been at court too long to trust his own reactions. His secretary found him some time with Domina Baddock that afternoon. Rial went down to her office, because it was beneath his dignity as Lord Eridus to do so, and also because it would be cruel to ask a woman with breathing difficulties to trek up the stairs to his office. When they met in the outer offices of the Treasury, low down in the main block of the palace, where the light was low and slanting throughout the day, and the architects had done wondrous things with greenish-gray and silver marble. "What brings you here?" the Domina asked. "The new Imperial Secretary, in a way," he told her. "In what way?" she said, sounding a little suspicious. Her skeptical expression softened a little when Rial explained about his job offer, but returned in full force when he finished by saying, "I know he was working for me, technically, but most of what he did was in partnership with you. So I wanted to know how you felt about working with him, and whether you would be interested in joining too, if I do accept his offer." "No," she said flatly. "Absolutely not. Don't get me wrong, I like Cleofer," she added hastily. "But it was difficult enough working with the man." She paused to recover her breath following that emphatic statement. Rial waited patiently until she was comfortable enough to finish her thought. "There is no incentive on Zunith, or any other world, that could persuade me to work for him.
What made it difficult?
Cleofert Ndang is a force of nature, she said. I have never met anyone so enamored with his work. He hardly rests. We went through everything in the archives, everything I have ever studied, every principle for financial reporting in half a year. He never asks you to take the papers home, but he works at such a pace that you can only keep up with him that way. I'm sure that he will do great things as Imperial Secretary. I will study them one day. But I want to go home when the Alanoral Gate is restored, before I get much older.
She smiled at him, and he thought how lovely her long silvery hair was in the sunlight.
I will send you everything that Tara has on auditing, if you take the job.
You think I might?
He raised an eyebrow. She raised one back at him.
I have given enough careers advice to my students to know when someone has already made their decision.
She was not wrong, thought Rial, as he ambled slowly back towards his office. He had needed to hear her views, but he had not been surprised by them or deterred. Domina Baddock had her career as a professor of accounting to return to, if she could get back to Alanor. If her part of Alanor had survived the fall, if the University of Tara still stood by the Circle C, if. He had so little beyond his work, and what remained of his household. He knew how important an audit could be. He knew that he could run audits for the Emperor objectively, skillfully, and it would be a way to be part of things, again, to serve the government of Zunith in his way. The thought of how furious his father would be at the very idea lent it a certain extra appeal.
Chapter 2. As simple as that.
Rial's feet had taken him past the turning to his office, and he was climbing yet another set of stairs before he realized where he was going and why. The palace apartments for lesser nobles were arrayed along the grand corridors of the mid-level floors, all much of a muchness, but this route was familiar enough that he could have followed it in his sleep. There had been times when he almost had, when the tides of court politics allowed. Some years had passed since he came this way, though, and he found he was unsure how he would be received. Lady Cuyulush's chief attendant, Dwinilor, ushered him in with his customary warmth. Rial thanked him and settled down to wait for the lady to emerge, which she did after the flatteringly short interlude of a half-bell.
"Eerie!" she trilled,
gliding across the room with every sign of eager welcome. He stood to greet her. There would be no comfortable slackening of Ostandalin court etiquette in this meeting. Lura Cuyulush delighted in every nuance. She fluttered her fan as he gave her a carefully calculated admirer's bow, then returned a shimmering half-curtsy of her own. He might be an ignoramus when it came to clothing, but Rial knew better than to greet Lura without making a point of admiring her outfit. Trains of sequins flared about her figure as she moved, accentuating those broad shoulders and strong calves. The rich turquoise shifted across shining slivers of peach-colored silk underneath, and the whole ensemble glowed against the misty gray and pearlescent off-white silk hangings. She grinned under his long assessing look, and shifted a little to set the trains of sequins rustling.
"Dwinny, dearest, would you go and find us a nibble or two?" she asked, adding the gesture which emphasized she wanted a private conversation.
Dwinilor bowed his way out and they sat. Rial regarded Lura with his court face concealing his pure pleasure in her company. She was his one indulgence, perhaps a luxury, the one person he had found in the whole palace who shared his wry discomfort with the aristocracy from within it. Never mind that she chose to embody its wildest fashions. She made them her own, stretched the glitz and glamour in directions that his family would have found as shocking as his own entire disinterest. As the daughter of old Lord Cuyulush, she was, technically, very much junior to the sole surviving lord of House Eridus. He rejoiced, therefore,
and letting her speak first and set the tone of the conversation, which she did, as soon as Dwinnilore was out of sight, by scrunching her long legs up onto the chair and twisting them comfortably underneath her. "Well, darling," she said, "what brings you to my humble abode?" He relaxed his own posture, twisting his legs together underneath his chair in the least manly pose he could make comfortable.
"I want career advice," he said, to make her laugh.
"From moi?" She fluttered her fan again. "I am quite overcome."
"You know the personalities in question," he told her. "Myself, of course. And a certain fifth-degree secretary."
"Ooh," she said, sounding thrilled. "Our old friend, Cupcake Cleofer." She grinned in triumph as this startled him into a bark of unguarded laughter.
"The very same," he said, when he had recovered his composure. "Whatever advice you gave him before he joined my office seems to have been effective, and now he's asking if I want a job."
Lyra clapped her hands. "But this is too perfect. Did you know that he has just fired me?"
"He what?"
"My dear, I regret to tell you that I am no longer a minister. I am naturally inconsolable."
"Naturally," said Riel dryly.
Lady Cuyelusha's ministerial role had been a total fiction with a salary attached. He had always found that reprehensible and told her so, and she had smirked and taken it anyway and ignored him. On reflection, perhaps there had been more than one reason why Ndang joined his office in such an aggressive mood.
"What did you say to him?"
Riel asked, out of pure curiosity. "About sacking me? Nothing yet. It came by letter. I would take that avoidance as a backhanded compliment, but the monster had a list and ticked off a good number of us parasites together. No doubt he and Indrigan were simply too busy to come round and break the news in person, so I'm biding my time before replying." She stretched a little and winked at him.
"What did you say to him before? About his career, I mean,"
Riel clarified. "Oh, well, I asked him what the hell he was doing drifting around with me, since he cared so much about fixing things," she said. "If you ever need an afternoon's entertainment, darling Eerie, you absolutely must get Cupcake aside and ask him what's wrong with the government. I have to admit I fell asleep while he was talking, and possibly also died a little inside, but I did manage to hide it, and I think I heard most of what he had to say."
"You listened to his views on the government, then told him to get on with it."
Riel could not quite keep the surprise out of his voice. Yes, she said. "Unexpected, isn't it? It made me so angry, all that passion going to waste. And besides, I knew Indrigan could do with a kick in the arse."
"You wished him on me," said Riel, thinking back over what had happened at least a year ago now. Possibly much longer, if you counted by the turning of the seasons, which he tried not to do these days. It was disconcerting to have possibly lived over a century, and even more so when he considered that most of the time seemed to have been spent in the office.
Lyra Cuyelush occasionally did approach him at court, mostly when she was in need of a straight man for a joke. She was never knowingly unkind, though. He knew himself to be quite hopelessly dull beside her, but he enjoyed her company, which was always entertaining, and she professed to enjoy his. That evening had started much as usual, except that Lyra had had Cleofer Syot and Dang trailing after her, in imitation of those members of the upper secretariat who had some reason to bring their secretaries to evening court, or even to have secretaries in the first place. It was the sort of exhibitionism the court associated with Lush Cuyelush. She had been cheerfully oblivious about showing the poor man off like some kind of prized pony, too. The part where she wagered his services on a card game had seemed like a prank at first, until she went through with it. "I trusted you to give him a start," she said now, as serious as he had ever seen her. I suspected the results would be spectacular. I am pleased, but surprised that he survived, to be honest. Cupcake has brains, all right, but his court manners, ugh, I did my best, but he never really saw the funny side to all this. She flirted a hand. Stylish nonsense.
Neither do I, said Rial.
No, you don't, darling. She reached across to pat his cheek, which he tolerated with a faint, controlled, socially appropriate smile. You've had it all beaten into you, though, my poor dear. The words were delivered gently, but her eyes were sharp with sympathy. Rial caught his breath at this razor honesty.
Yes, he said simply, though it cost him to hold composure.
Lyra pulled back, just far enough to create space between them for his words. He managed a smile.
I don't have your flair or your courage, either of you, he said. But I am intrigued. I prefer Ndang's version of the service to anything else I've ever seen, to be honest.
You're as addled as he is, she said fondly. Give him my dearest love, why don't you? And ask him whether the Emperor does appreciate his haunches. There's a dear. She was sliding back into her more usual mode. Formal body language, risque chatter. So Rial took this in his stride.
I'm sure he'd prefer that question came from you, he said, and rose to give her his most formal bow of thanks between peers.
She stood to return it, with an extra sachet and a flicker of sequins. For a moment they looked at one another, mutually amused, and then Lyra stepped closer and seized the top of his robes, gently twisting the silk.
You've been here over a bell, and I have a reputation to maintain, she said, her voice sinking just a little lower, a little huskier.
He looked up into her eyes, tawny brown and soft as thistledown, and saw in them, new in himself, the myriad calculations of the court. Lord Iridis and Lady Kuyalush, long rumored to be lovers, but only as a sort of admiring joke, he thought, of which, mostly unfairly, Lyra seemed to be the butt and he the sly dog. His potential new position, allied to a rising palace star, her loss of her sinecure. The pair of them, a little out of the focus of gossip right now, as the aristocracy was swinging away to support the rival camps and the growing power struggle on the other side of the world. The frustration that they shared, at the strictures of Astandalus, and the ways in which they both embodied the court, even as they reject it. With Lyra, he never had to explain.
Later, he said, only slightly hoarse. After work.
She gripped his robes tighter and lowered her lips to his. He turned his face up and let himself sink forward into her embrace. Lyra kissed as she talked, sly, teasing, sincere when it served her purpose. For a moment or two, the ledgers or ramifying calculations receded, as two odd halves made a whole. Rial felt the familiar heady rush of her presence, the brief ecstasy as her tongue slipped between his lips, the soft firmness of her, the gentle questioning. And then the palace bell chimed, a reassertion of reality that made him draw back just slightly. They slipped apart. Later, she agreed, and they both knew it was political, and also that it was not entirely. And that, for them, for now, as it had been in the past, until the calculation shifted, that was enough. As soon as he got back to his office, Rial sent a page up with a note asking for a brief conversation with the Imperial Secretary. He was trying to settle back down into reviewing his department's latest risk register and to stop the back of his brain sketching out audit plans when the page returned to say that Siout Ndang could spare 15 minutes at the next bell, if that was both sufficient and convenient. It occurred to Rial, as he hurried up the stairs, that Siout Ndang might truly have meant both those qualifiers. He had always been polite and never given to petty power games. If Riel had sent the page scurrying back to his office with a request for a meeting tomorrow instead, in all likelihood the imperial secretary would have been completely unruffled and would have tried to fit him in. It would certainly have been a better move to play with a court insider, to exert his independence, and yet Riel didn't want to send back a stiff little deferral and spend the afternoon at his desk reviewing risk mitigation policy for trade. The imperial secretary's private office was currently crammed into a series of small working rooms that curved round the center of the palace, right up against the imperial apartments. Riel had not been inside the tower since he was a young teenager, when he was still considered presentable as an addition to his father's many, many suits to the Lord Emperor. Old Lord Eridus had delighted in his right as a noble to seek imperial audiences directly, and had found a reason to do so 3 or 4 times a year at least. Walking past the great doors, with the sigil of the sun resplendent against the ivory and black, Riel remembered the sticky sense of discomfort he felt every time they were admitted, the Emperor's expressionless distaste, his father's fawning, his own fear. In those days, the whole palace had been abuzz with activity, particularly in the busy seasons when the lords and ladies magi were in Astandalus, and all the great nobles gathered. Now, in the tower, the buzz was back, at least in part. There were no passing knots of nobles or outworlders in strange garments, but Riel saw pages in several different liveries, passing guards, a pair of priest wizards in their silvery robes, and dozens of bureaucrats of all grades and disciplines. Riel felt his pulse speed up, just a little. With so much of the rest of the palace left quiet and empty, it was energizing to be around so many people who seemed to have found a purpose. After a couple of attempts, he found the office that the imperial secretary allegedly worked in. It was not a private study, but an open space with several ranks of desks and, at the moment, a notable lack of Siop and Dang. As he had arrived shortly after the bell, Riel had expected to wait around for a moment or two. He had not expected to be waiting perched on what seemed like a battered old kitchen chair shoved into the back corner of the room behind Siop and Dang's own desk, watching curiously as a team of, by their clothes, analysts exclaimed over some findings that they were passing around. One woman reached up and clutched at her hat dramatically. A man sitting opposite almost snatched the paper across the table and scrawled something in the corner, then held it up and shook it at her. Beyond them, a few pages were shifting papers into and out of a set of 3 open dispatch boxes. On the other side of the room, there were 2 desks completely surrounded by silent, focused, scribbling figures in secretarial robes. Incongruously, one of the secretaries at the near end was absent-mindedly stroking a large black cat, who lay sprawled across the set of what looked like technical reference books to one side of him. The cat, to Riel's delight, was wearing, or at least tolerating, a tiny red sash on its collar, turning it into a miniature version of the analyst's belts. Absorbed though he was in the byplay, Riel was aware at once of the slight shift in dynamics, the tautening of attention that signaled Siop and Dang's return to the room. He was trailing 3 more pages in a little procession that broke up as they came in, each heading energetically in a different direction. Dang himself made straight for Riel, who started to rise but was firmly gestured back into his seat. The new imperial secretary was still wearing the robes of his former rank in the 5th degree, a russet brown almost certainly designed primarily to act as a backdrop for the aristocrats in the upper secretariat to pose against. Riel was almost entirely sure that this costume was a force of habit, or perhaps Ndang not allowing himself the time to go and find a new set of robes in the black and red he was now entitled to. But in the language of the court, it was also a show of raw power. "I am secure in my status," it said. "It is your job to know who and what I am, not mine to display it to you." "Lord Eridus, thank you for coming on such short notice," said Mdang, as if he were the one who had asked for Riel's time. "Oh, yes, the message of those robes was most definitely an accident. That didn't make it any less accurate." "My pleasure," said Riel, which was fully correct according to the Astandalan script, and then, in response to the robes and the blunt approach, and the fact that he just liked Ndang, he added, "I couldn't stay away from the prospect of a good round of audits." Which was entirely incorrect and far too keen, whether from a lord to a commoner, or from an applicant to a prospective employer. Siop Ndang gave him a conspiratorial grin, pulled across a notebook, and said, "We have only managed one so far, but I have great hopes. His Radiancy is fully behind the concept of auditing every department in turn, though with the team I have at the moment, that would take us several years to achieve. We have the budget to bring in 3 more teams before the end of the court session, but that means we'll need to train them up. So we'll want to balance that against the need to hit the likely worst offenders sooner rather than later. And I have to admit that I'm not confident that the whole of His Radiancy's government is in a reasonable enough state to implement any recommendations. So we'll need repeat visits at intervals, which will also have to be factored in. Lord Lovelace told you that I'm looking for someone to coordinate all of this." "Yes," said Rial, slightly dizzy at the vista opening up before him. "He told me a little about what you found at the treasury." "I'll give you a copy of the report to read," Ndang promised with a grimace. "It's not pretty." "Well, the best approach is going to depend on the size of the team. How many analysts have you got your hands on so far?" "It depends on if you care how experienced they are. I've got a whole set of likely trainees, numerate, curious, not afraid to ask questions." "That's a gift," said Iridis absently, tugging the notebook over and skimming the draft schedules. He felt his eyebrows shoot up. "You've included the Ordinatha." "They receive funds on behalf of the Emperor," said Ndang, as if it was that simple. "I don't have any magic users, though," he added, "and in the first instance I'm thinking primarily of finance and admin process audits. His Radiancy can keep track of their arcane business." At Riel's skeptical look, he went on, "I expect them to refuse anything but the barest look at their books. But we will have to insist on that. Believe me, we will get it. His Radiancy is not best pleased with the priest wizards. You can..." He caught himself. "I'm sorry, I'm making assumptions." "I can insist," said Rial, giddy at the thought. "If you'll back me, certainly." He was vaguely aware that he had entirely lost track of the proper Ostandalan courtly response, and also that he fundamentally did not care. He was grinning like a boy, like he seldom had as a boy. And perhaps it was as simple as that. Perhaps together they could just disregard what was proper and do what was right. 15 minutes was hardly long enough to scratch the surface, but Siop Ndang let him take the notebook in return for the promise to be back the next day to meet the audit teams and to move up permanently as soon as he was able. Back in his own office, Rial drafted a letter of resignation for Indergen and acceptance for Ndang. He hesitated over the audit plans, then put them firmly aside to finish reading through the risk register, because that was his responsibility. If his free hand rested on the notebook, well, it was good to have a solid reminder under his fingers that today had not been a dream. His family were long lost on Isthar, and the gentle green valleys he loved and tended as a young man were gone too. And he had spent too long walking around with his head in the past. It was time to recognize that Ostandalus was lost, and neither its beauties nor its ghosts should rule him any longer. And because that reflection was alive in his eyes when he met them in the mirror in his chamber, he repeated it to Vobu. The hand shifting his work robes down his shoulders froze with uncharacteristic suddenness, and then shook slightly. Vobu's face was in shadow, and Rial could not read his expression in the mirror. He thought, "To hell with this," and shrugged out of his sleeves himself, so that he could turn and look at his attendant directly. "Vobu," he began. "You're right," said Vobu. He did not add, "my lord." "I Rial began, feeling his familiar helpless sense of inadequacy rising, but determined to revisit this conversational ground. They had both been avoiding this for a half century too long.
I don't think I need an attendant, but I wanted you to feel wanted for as long as you needed.
The robe slipped out of Vobu's hands in a rustle of silk and puddled on the floor between them. Rial bent down awkwardly to pick it up and stood holding it, waiting for Vobu to speak.
It did help, said Vobu at last, his face working. Especially at first. But I was so angry at you.
Rial sighed and scrunched the silk inexpertly together.
Thank you, he said, though he wasn't sure if that was for the reassurance or for the willingness to follow his lurch into interpersonal honesty. Either, both. Shall we start again? I owe you for so many years. You can stay in my household as long as you like, or do something else.
He hesitated again, at the edge of acceptability, but he wanted to be curious, not afraid to ask questions. And there was an imbalance here, a debt that he ought to make good.
You don't have to tell me at once, or at all, he said. But, Vobu, what do you want now, for yourself?
Vobu's eyes were wide in what could have been shock or horror, the whites showing clear all round his pupils.
I don't know, he whispered. Will you take some time to think it over? You don't have to tell me about it, Rial said again. But let me know what you want from me. Anything or nothing or...
Vobu reached forward and snatched the crumpled robe out of his hands.
Oh, give me that before you ruin it, he said.
Then, I will leave you to your evening and let you know. The shift in Vobu's tone, that unheard of censure, the open uncertainty, was the relief of a weight he had not known had grown so heavy. Rial sucked in his breath, lightheaded.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Vobu hooked the silk robes over a chair and left without looking back. Rial, staring after him, felt the ache of long tension abruptly released, the emptiness that loosed burden left behind. And then, he was alone in his chambers, as he never had been. He was free. After a few minutes of opening and closing wardrobe doors, he had never felt comfortable looking through his own clothes, here and where Vobu's domain. Rial found a plain and soothing linen robe that he had almost forgotten owning. He threw it on, sank into an armchair, and pulled out the notebook. He had an hour or so to spare before Lura would expect him, and a great deal of strategizing to do. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this Podfix post. Thank you for listening.